interview with Mr. Chuck Gray conducted on October 30th, 2003 in Fairbanks at Chuck's home by Roger Kay. Well, thanks for agreeing to talk to me today about particularly your role and testimony and so on related to creation of what became the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I'd like to first start, Chuck, by asking you, when did you come to Alaska and what brought you here?
I came to Alaska in 1943 with my parents. My dad had come up with construction work from Illinois, and he arranged to have facilities for us to arrive here that fall just in time for school. I was 15 then, my brother was 14,
mm-hmm.
and we've been here ever since.
Hmm.
The town was about 4,500 during the war, and all the housing was taken up, and much like the pipeline boom days, there was people stacked and wherever they could be, and we were lucky enough to find a place that a single guy owned that had been drafted and gone to war, and the caretakers allowed us to move into it. So we had pretty good housing during that time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And maybe you could just give me a brief kind of summary of your career and how it unfolded here in Fairbanks.
Well, I started out high school here as a sophomore. Finished up, of course. Help was scarce during those war years, and one of the kids worked part-time at Alaska Star Airlines, later became Alaska Airlines, and I kind of had a job lined up for the summer there, but in the meantime, another one of the kids that worked at the newspaper said they needed some help, and wondered if I'd be interested in working evenings after school. And I did, and it developed that I stayed on the rest of my working years for about 48.
Mm-hmm.
And I had 2 years out, more or less, during the Korean War when I was drafted and spent time at Eielson Air Force Base, actually as a military game warden.
Hmm.
But also, I had started the food engraving plant at the newspaper, and so I actually did that two or three evenings a week just to produce the local pictures that they needed.
Mm-hmm.
So my time was almost unbroken during my newspaper years,
mm-hmm.
and when I got one of the great things about the 2 years that I was a military and game warden, I had the opportunity, of course, to work out of the Fish and Wildlife Office, and particularly with Frank Grazer, who was the predator control agent. And he ended up, when I applied for guide license, probably in 1954, the requirements were you pass a little written test and be recommended by a guide. So Frank endorsed me as a guide, and as a result of my time with him, and I believe that's probably the only person he ever did, and it's quite an honor, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So my guiding was simply a very part-time thing that extended over 41 years, and it was just like a one-on-one guiding thing where I did a limited amount. But we did everything from polar bear to walrus to brown bear and all the interior game.
Mm-hmm. So that leads into my next question. In your testimony, it's noted that you are one of the few, and perhaps the only person, who really knew the proposed Arctic Refuge, both the south and the north side. So I was wondering if you could tell me what some of your history of the use of what became the Arctic Refuge was in the 1950s.
Well, I'd most of my hunting and guiding was on the south side of the range, all the way from the Noatak to the Colleen. But and eventually ended up with an area where I took out a headquarters site and, mm-hmm. in the central south range. But probably most of my activity was in the springtime when we extended into the range when we were doing area wolf hunting.
Mm-hmm.
The north, this was after the Fish and Wildlife had their big hunt up there in 1953,
mm-hmm.
which they credited themselves with something like 350 wolves or something.
Mm-hmm.
And probably a lot more than that because they also poisoned a lot of their the kills that they mm-hmm. saw, so mm-hmm. never went back to check them or anything.
Really?
But nevertheless, by the time we were doing that, in the, from about 55 on, why there was a lot of wolves up there, and our record hunting out of Anantuvik Pass was 156 in 5 days of hunting.
Really? And that one or two super cubs?
Two super cubs.
Mm-hmm. And you were using your own cub at the time.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Did you ever meet Ed Owen when you were up there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A couple of times we stopped by the river on the Colleen, mm-hmm. where Ed's place was,
mm-hmm.
and he was all by himself in the by that time,
mm-hmm.
a very elderly fella. He had formerly raised a family there,
mm-hmm.
And he'd been part of the surveyors that surveyed the, mm-hmm. the boundary between the Yukon and the mm-hmm. Alaska in the early days, and he liked the country, and I guess just stayed on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So going back to the Arctic Refuge, when did you first hear about the proposal to withdraw Northeast Alaska?
Well, it'd be hard for me to put a date on that, but fortunately from the material you've given me, which contains some of my testimony and things, mm-hmm. why I guess it was prior to 1954, mm-hmm. because in 1954, I see I'd written a letter to the editor of the newspaper, which employees were allowed to do those in those days.
Uh-huh.
Later on, I figured it wasn't too ethical. People mm-hmm. that worked there
mm-hmm.
had an inside track anyway. So, mm-hmm. but anyway, by 1954, I'd certainly formed an opinion that, that it wasn't a good thing to do under the Park Service plans. And of course, we all thought of the Park Service as being a very lock-up type of operation,
mm-hmm.
Favoring the animals over people.
mm-hmm. Yeah, at the time, do you remember who from the Park Service was talking about or promoting this idea?
I think the first person I knew about was Olus Murray.
Mm-hmm.
They came to Fairbanks, and I can't put a date on that. I believe from in reviewing the testimony of myself and Glenda Spain in what year is on this?
59.
Mm-hmm. That Murray had certainly been here a few years earlier than that because he appeared, I remember being at Tanoa Valley Sportsman Association meeting where he appeared and hoped to enlist their help in forming some type of a refuge up there or a reserve of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
But somewhat later, I met George Collins, who was still trying to promote something for the Park Service.
Mm-hmm.
And my best date on that, I know that that Collins called me and asked me if I could get four or five people together for a meeting at our house.
Hmm.
And we moved into this house in 1967, and it was sometime a few years after that. So I'm going to say it was approximately 70 or 72.
Hmm.
And he was still pushing. You see, my recollection is that Seton set that area aside as a, was it a refuge first?
A range.
A range, mm-hmm. Okay. As the last, kind of the last thing in the Eisenhower administration, mm-hmm. as a payoff to, for the environmentalists pulling back from objections to statehood. And so then there was a period between the Native Claims Settlement Act and ANILCA that that all this, these federal withdrawals were kind of in limbo. Mm-hmm. The Native Claims Settlement Act said that that the government would look at up to 80 million acres to mm-hmm. be set aside in various types of federal preserves. Mm-hmm. And so during this period of 8 years, the federal agencies were all scrambling to try to grab it for their own mm-hmm. selves. Mm-hmm. And so during that time, I think that Collins was still trying to convince some of us that it should be a part.
Yeah.
Well, the group that he got together, or we got together, was, he didn't persuade us in the least.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that had any effect on anything. Mm-hmm. But apparently there were other people that were, anyway, it finally came around to being more acceptable as a refuge.
Mm-hmm.
And personally, I endorsed that for mm-hmm. what little good that might have done. I mm-hmm. see in one of mm-hmm. Senator Bartlett's hearings in Fairbanks, and eventually, that, of course, mm-hmm. what it ended up.
Yeah, in looking at your testimony in 59, you talk about, I guess, a change of mind, and you supported it, and you spoke in terms of quality hunting. Let's see, I think I can... Well, you, in looking at your testimony here, you favored the proposed wildlife range because you were concerned about the quality of hunting and what was happening in Alaska, and you referred to wishing to maintain, and I'll quote you here, genuine, old-fashioned hunting trips. Could you tell me a little bit about that concern that you had that might have led you to support the refuge proposal?
Well, I think the type of guided hunting trips that were available in Alaska before World War II were long trips and which took time and effort to get into an area and out, often by horseback or boat. And it was fairly obvious that with the development of Super Cub around 1950, that it's going to be possible to circumvent those long trips and just plop in about anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so Cubs developed first with lower horsepower engines, and they were increased a couple times. And first of all with a small light gear, and then there were was the Whitaker gear, a tandem gear that mm-hmm. came along, was pretty popular, except when you turn too sharp while you pull valve stems up. And then the larger Tundra tires and even eventually up to 36 inch. And of course, it's happened pretty much the way I thought it would. We got into, many of the guys got into mass production hunts where they're dropping people off and all over the country for very short times. So I guess it's something that was inevitable, but that I could see having an area where it could be controlled a little bit, and I think it has been. It's there's even the guiding in the refuge is controlled much better than it is in the state now, and so mm-hmm. guides aren't on each other's back, so it's basically worked out pretty well.
Mm-hmm. You kind of are visionary in that you were anticipating the possible use of helicopters, and you were looking ahead and thinking this area might preclude helicopter hunting. Do you recall that?
Yeah, I think the basis of that was that during World War II, there was a lot of hunting by the military, and even a few years afterwards with their helicopters. And things that that type were witnessed by other civilian hunters in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And if helicopters weren't curtailed, it would just be really disastrous to game. Well, fortunately, they have been curtailed. The military, I don't think, abuses it much anymore, and the loss of a helicopter and a game violation scares all those who have them enough that I just think it didn't develop to be a problem.
Yeah. You mentioned the military, and I see in a lot of the early literature that a lot of conservationist concerns were based on what they saw the military doing or planning to do. Do you recall of concern about the military?
In reading some of the things that that happened during the war years, General Buckner was in charge of military in Alaska, and he was quite adamant that the troops here be given almost complete freedom to hunt without restriction, and his interest was just in their recreational activities, and because they were in an environment where there wasn't much else to do. And he clashed constantly with the Alaska Game Commission and local wardens, and in the end he had to back down quite a bit, more or less abide by the regulations. And So that kind of left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths immediately after war. That doesn't seem to be a problem anymore.
Yeah, Chuck, could you tell me a little bit more about Olaus Murie? I know you were an officer in the Tanana Valley Sportsman's Association, and I think you attended a meeting or two in which he spoke to the group.
Well, my connection with the TVSA was a little later than that. I mean, I was secretary for 2 or 3 years while Jack Boswell was president. But I was at the meeting when Olaus appeared, and of course I don't remember anything about it now, except that he was advocating this this northeast area be set aside as something. And I kind of have the impression that this was before he and his wife spent some time in the summer up there, and a book came out about it, but I'm not even sure about that. And then he stayed in town for a few days. He was making other contacts, but I think he depended on trying to convince the TVSA to support it, that would probably be the most effective help he could get, at least in Fairbanks. And then while he was here, I met him on the bridge crossing over the town one day, and we had a little short talk. He said he got out for a walk every morning, and I had to cross the bridge from where I lived to work. And of course, my impression was that he was a very mild-mannered probably fairly effective just for that reason. He was sincere, and he had facts, that's basically all I remember about him.
Mm-hmm. Did he have a reputation for his travels through the country in the 20s, or were you aware of that?
Yeah, I think I was aware of that. Yeah, he had married a Fairbanks girl, and made a long dog team trip on their honeymoon with a kayak or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that gave him some credibility in Fairbanks, sure.
Mm-hmm. So his approach was fairly low-key, you're saying, to try to get the TVSA to endorse this?
Yes, exactly.
did it appear to you to be a bit preservationist for your liking at the time, or?
Well, under Park Service, it would have been. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that was my initial opposition.
Mm-hmm.
But when it finally it was obvious it was going to be something else, why I could support that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the in reading back the testimony of Glenn Despain at the Bartlett hearing in 59,
mm-hmm.
that the TVSA's position was set out very clearly and,
mm-hmm.
and very reasonably,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's what we're all depending on,
mm-hmm.
hoping.
Yeah.
It could happen.
Now, interesting that OLAS focused so much on TVSA, more than any group. There's more correspondence he mentions in letters that he needs to meet with them time and time again. What was it about TVSA? Did they have quite a bit of political influence at that time?
Yeah, I'd say so. They were. There's only two sportsmen's groups in Alaska then, I think, Territorial Sportsmen at Juneau and,
mm-hmm.
and TVSA in Fairbanks. And they had a fair amount of clout. They would kind of hold hearings every year and make recommendations to the game commission and
mm-hmm.
and later they became more watered down and
mm-hmm.
they didn't take strong positions on anything and,
uh-huh.
and became more of a rifle.
Mm.
Shooting group, that's really what's held it together
mm.
in the last many years.
Uh-huh.
And as a result of that, why some other groups came along to take more definite positions on wildlife matters, like Interior Wildlife Association,
mm-hmm.
and then more recently the Alaska Outdoor Coalition.
Right.
And so the TVSA has kind of been left in the dust as far as the clout they used to have.
Mm-hmm. But in the 50s, they were pretty politically strong.
Yeah,
obviously, they made strong statements.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Interesting. Let me go back to the news miners out now. In 1957, the paper officially endorsed the refuge range proposal, and they went on to write a couple editorial columns strongly supporting it. Why did the news miners support this proposal?
Well, I think probably the main reason would be because the publisher, owner of the news miner, Bill Snedden,
mm-hmm.
had become very good friends with Fred Seaton, the Interior Secretary of the Interior,
mm-hmm.
and they worked together in Washington to bring about statehood.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently something that they had agreed on, and particularly Seaton had agreed on, is that there'd be some payoff to the conservationists for not objecting to statehood.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in the end, it seemed like maybe Congress had an opportunity to do something with the range,
mm-hmm.
but that Seaton thought he was duty-bound to see that it happened. So in the last days of the Eisenhower administration,
mm-hmm.
he that proclaimed it, and,
mm-hmm.
and Eisenhower signed it. And but this was simply part of the strategy for obtaining statehood.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Snedden at the News Miner was his effectiveness was certainly known, and the weekly news magazines recognized that
mm-hmm.
Later. But he would work behind the scenes a lot, but he spent about half his time in Washington for the last 3 or 4 years before the statehood
mm-hmm.
vote.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, incidentally, he was the one that recommended Ted Stevens for a position in the Department of Interior, a solicitor, who really became an active person there, working also the statehood battle in Washington. And of course, Bill Snedden first knew Ted Stevens because after law school, he came to Fairbanks. He worked for Collins and Clasby law firm and was assigned to the Newsminer as the attorney, the Newsminer's attorney.
Really?
One of the first things I remember by him is I was doing some flying from the newspaper by then, and the liability thing came up, and so Ted whipped out a liability release form that I used when I hauled people.
Is that, interesting.
Well, Snedden recognized that Stevens was very bright and helped him along.
In the mid-50s, or perhaps it was 57, when the Newsminer first endorsed the Range proposal, would Snedden have been the publisher, or was it Ryan or someone else?
Well, Snedden was publisher, owner and publisher from 1950 when he bought it until his death. And that was in 88, I guess. But Jack Ryan was the editor, managing editor at the years we're talking about. And so most of the editorials would have been written by Jack. You probably if there's anything other than motherhood, it would have been discussed probably with Bill Snedden. And often by telephone to, from Washington, because he spent a lot of time back there. So I think you could probably be pretty sure that Jack Ryan wrote the editorials that actually wrote the editorial that you're talking about.
But there wouldn't, perhaps, would it be known whether Ryan and or Snedden personally were interested in establishing a Range, or whether their stance was more strategic?
My opinion, and I wasn't in management at that time at the paper, but would be that it was, if you want to call it strategic or political, it was not, it was probably not because they had a great interest in preserving a, a wild area for hunting or whatever.
Okay. How about Clarence Rode? I know you knew Clarence, and once you told me you had flown with him. Clarence became more, I guess, active in the campaign in the later 50s, and perhaps he was a person that hunters could more identify with, or what he was interested in was more in line with people. Is that, what's your impression of that?
The latter part of what you said is certainly true. Clarence was a kind of a guy that hunters could relate to. He wasn't a trained biologist or anything, but you may remember that in the years the spring of 1953, I think it was, when the Fish and Wildlife Service had a large predator control hunt and program on the North Slope to be sure that the same thing didn't happen in Alaska that had happened in the Northwest Territories in the Yukon, and that's that the caribou had just pretty much disappeared, and the native people were on welfare or dying. And the biologists here had been arguing for a couple of years about, and there weren't many biologists in those days. One of them was Ed Chatelain that came up from Anchorage occasionally. Bob Scott worked out at the university mainly. But anyway, they couldn't agree on whether there should be predator control north of the range or not. Well, after a certain amount of time, Clarence finally said, "Oh, the heck with all this argument." He said, "We're just going to kill the wolves up there." And they did. So Clarence, he could relate to the need to preserve the caribou up there, and he was definitely a something that sportsmen would agree with and relate to.
Olaus Murray was very much against wolf control, and particularly in this area. I wonder if that debate came out or it was public, the difference between Rode and Murray's approach towards predators.
I don't remember that either the Murray's played a part in, for instance, the decision to do something on North Slope. Mm-hmm. There may have been correspondence and things mm-hmm. that we wouldn't have heard about.
Mm-hmm.
But, Olaus's half-brother, Adolf, had done work in the park
mm-hmm.
and had been very influential in helping form policy in the Park Service.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in the park at the time the Park Service made this concession where they would let the rangers shoot a few wolves a year, maybe six or so, just mm-hmm. to appease the Alaskans, and at the same time not do any harm to their numbers.
Mm-hmm.
That was a lot of... we heard those kind of things all the time in outdoor groups and
mm-hmm.
discussions and that type of thing. But I just can't say that I remember them mm-hmm. being outside the park. Mm-hmm. And Olaus did spend a little time in the park, mm-hmm. I think one summer with his brother or something, mm-hmm. if I remember right. But I can't remember them having much of a hand in the decisions to do predator control mm-hmm. work elsewhere in Alaska.
Mm. Olaus came representing the Wilderness Society, and at the same time he worked with what became the Alaska Conservation Society. I was wondering if those two groups were at odds with TVSA at all on, say, wolf control or an approach towards Northeast Alaska.
Well, wolf control was a big thing in those years,
mm-hmm.
a big item, and but those groups were not too well organized or effective at that time.
Mm.
They existed. Celia Hunter and Jenny Wood, they were about the only voices we heard
mm-hmm.
on the other side.
Uh-huh.
And it was years later before they actually got more people on their side and had an office
mm-hmm.
and probably became equally or more effective than the sportsmen.
Mm. But in the 50s, it was probably TVSA that would be the most influential.
Yeah.
I wonder how many numbers TVSA had in the 50s. Do you have any idea?
No, I don't. Mm-hmm. I know they had a lot better attendance at meetings then.
Uh-huh.
They were, like, if it was going to be on recommendations for the game commission or something, it would be a packed house.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And, you know, probably 200 people or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Anymore, I think they have trouble getting the quorum together. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
25 or 50. But.
Yeah. How about John Buckley? He got involved, I think, he was a member of TVSA, wasn't he?
No doubt. He was always there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He headed up the wildlife unit at the college here.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember much about him in relation to the refuge.
Okay.
He probably, I'm sure he had an opinion or something, but he would, the 2 years I was hanging around the Fish and Wildlife office, he often dropped in.
Mm.
And he had a study area up on the Porcupine after a big fire there
mm-hmm.
to see how quick things came back. And,
mm-hmm.
and I know that Wolford would fly him up there a time or two every winter and in the summer, and
mm-hmm.
he'd apparently tromp around and see what was happening.
mm-hmm. Another person, Bud Boddy, was in the Sportsman's Association in Juneau. Was that related or an affiliate with TVSA, do you remember?
No, there was. It wasn't affiliated in any way. That was a territorial sportsman.
Oh.
They still call themselves that, I think. No, it was just the other main club in Alaska, and so there was correspondence back and forth and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Something did come about for a few years there where there was an affiliation of, where they had joint meetings
mm-hmm.
every year or two, I can't just remember. Mm-hmm. Somebody like Glenn Despain could fill you in a lot better on that.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember attending one at the university here where the Juneau people were up here, and it was like a 2 or 3 day affair with seminars and things.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been about the period of time again that you're talking about.
Mm. Okay. Well, Chuck, that's all the questions I had, and I want to thank you, but I also want to ask you any other things I may have not brought up or anything you'd like to add for the record.
Well, about the only thing I can think of is probably something we all wonder about is what is the future of the refuge?
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean whether or not a little corner of it gets drilled or not for oil,
mm-hmm.
but more... Can outdoors people, including hunters, continue to use it?
Mm-hmm.
It's a large area and pretty inaccessible. So some airplane access is needed,
mm-hmm.
and so far that's been preserved, I think, fairly reasonably.
Mm-hmm.
People have gotten in trouble of trying to improve runways on gravel bars a little bit and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But generally it's accessible. The guiding in the area has been well managed, I think, and better than elsewhere in the state. And I don't have any recommendations other than just go on pretty much like it is. Hopefully it'll be open to as much use and access as it is now.
Mm-hmm. What kind of hunting might this area especially provide, or what kind of experience, perhaps opposed to other places? Is there a special kind of experience this remote area ought to provide hunters?
Certainly the caribou migration through it in the fall on the south side is a very dramatic thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something worth seeing
mm-hmm.
and doing, being there. Otherwise, the grizzly and sheep and the moose population, of course, is way down there over what it was 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I talk about mostly the south side.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I think it's more just being above the Arctic and beautiful country and
mm-hmm.
and whatever that is.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks so much for sharing these thoughts.
That's what somebody told me, that our Creator said that. And I have a written closing statement which I'm going to read to you. We are proud people, the Kuchin people of the Yukon Flats in Northeast Alaska and Northwest Canada. By your city standards, we are also very poor people. In many villages, everything must be flown in by airplanes, and we have a village in Alaska with high costs in the nation on energy. Fuel oil especially costs somewhere in between, you know, $2.50 to $5 a gallon, and that's fuel oil. Most village food and other items are very expensive. In addition, many village unemployment exceed 90%. for much of the year, and only a few jobs are available in the summer. But we are subsistent people. Our main occupation is hunting and fishing. This way we can practice, we can feed our family and trade among our own people. Caribou from the Chandelier will give red meat to your family in the Yukon Flat. In return, Yukon salmon will find its way into the Chandelier villages. So long as we have our caribou fish, berries, and other products of the land that we live on, we can be happy. We have our culture, we have our heritage, we have our way of life. We can know the way of our forefather and have something to give to our children. Without caribou, without our way of life, what do we have? And who are we? I think this was said a long time ago. As long as we have these things, as long as you have your society to depend on, we know who we are. And from henceforth, we can join hands and teach to our leaders in the United States how to survive and how to solve some of these problems that we're talking about today for the good of human race. Thank you.
Well, thank you, John. That's very good. All right, we'll go right into our next panel, which is on state and environmental perspectives of the 1002 report. So those panelists will come up to the platform. We are going to change things slightly, since we do want to have two panels following this one. We're going to cut the break at the conclusion of the of this panel down to about 5 minutes, if you people will cooperate. And right around 3:05, we'll try to get started on the impacts of oil and gas development on the North Slope. The moderator of this panel will be Mike Matz, and I will let him introduce the panel members and tell you what the panel is discussing.
Thank you, Celia. This afternoon, we're going to be taking a look at the 1002 program of ANILCA for the benefit of those who may not know what that program is. I know that there are a lot of you out there who are intimately familiar with that whole process. And Ned Farquhar from the Department of Natural Resources, State Department of Natural Resources, will also discuss the state's own version of the 1002 report. We also have Roland Shanks from the Fish and Game Department of the state to discuss his agency's perspective on that particular section of ANILCA. We have Amy Skillbred, who was introduced earlier from Defenders of Wildlife. She will be helping us out analyze the 1002 process and how Fish and Wildlife Service is accomplishing that, as will Bob Adler, way down on the end there, from Trustees for Alaska. Essentially, 1002 section of ANILCA was one of the major debates of the whole process, and what they ended up was with a compromise whereby Fish and Wildlife Service was authorized to study the fish and wildlife of the coastal plain, put it together in reports, and continually update those reports with specific emphasis on some of the large game animals and other fish and other special features that were discussed earlier by Glenn Ellison. The second component of the 1002 report was then an assessment of the oil and gas potential on the coastal plain, and then using those two components there to compile that, Fish and Wildlife Services, into a report that will be submitted to Congress. Congress will take that information and decide then on the disposition of the coastal plain, whether or not to open it up to further oil and gas exploration and development, whether to leave it in the status quo, or whether to designate it wilderness. So now I think what we'd like to do is have Ned discuss the Department of Natural Resources' own version of the 1002 report. Ned?
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to say hello to the people I know that I haven't talked to yet. And it's good to see everybody that I do know here. Generally, I'm going to be rather brief because the state's perspective on the 1002 study is not all that profound or anything because of the fact that we haven't seen the results from it yet. But basically, the state has historically had a couple of areas of concern in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and prior to that, the range. And those are information gathering and the management that results from the information gathering process. During the D2 days, obviously the management of the Arctic Range and Refuge was a major issue in Washington, and the state expressed a lot of concern about the proposed management regimes that were considered by Congress, largely because the evaluations of both the surface resources, including the wildlife and the wilderness values in the area, and of the possible subsurface oil and gas potential in the area, were the evaluations of both of those resources were so promising. Basically, Congress found itself unable to establish a management regime permanently because it didn't feel that it had adequate information, and the controversy was so unfounded in information. Congress opted